The baby boomers led waves of dramatic culture changes. Their voices raise awareness of consumerism, retirement programs, higher education, healthcare, and civil rights transformations. Now, the baby boomers have reached an age where it is our turn to give back to them for their voices, their struggles, and their footprint on the society we benefit from today. Boomer Living TV's podcast is dedicated to the support and the enhancement of senior living and the baby boomers' needs and demands. We welcome conversations between caregivers, providers, gerontologists, geriatricians, neurologists, technologists, developers, and operators with one objective: to serve our baby boomers. By bringing together these experts and the baby boomers' families, we can share our knowledge that will educate and inspire others on how to care for the baby boomers. We're a social platform that focuses on the respect and care of this aging population that gave their youth and their wisdom to the society we benefit from today. Romy was the vice president of a Deutsche Bank. Then he later became president of Hampton Horter Healthcare, which is a technology company focused on providing digital solutions for senior healthcare management. He was also the president of Care Expo, which is China's largest multinational aged care B2B conference and trade show. He was also the president of Shen Chuan Moi, a senior living Le Moi, which is one of the largest senior healthcare companies in China. Most recently, he was a director of special programs, where he migrated quality assessment to an online platform, which would allow a greater quality assessment efficiency in tracking. He's very committed to finding better solutions, discovering overlooked opportunities in supply chains. He wants to implement disruptive technologies to leverage advantages in eliminating the systemness. Well, hello, Bromi. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. So tell me, what intrigued you about Asia and what are you doing in the senior living?
Well, it's a bit of a long story, but when I was a youngster back in the early 70s, my family moved to Taiwan, where we spent a number of years living there. My father ran a bank in Taiwan, and it was such a foreign, unusual place for me to live. Prior to moving to Taiwan, we lived in Madison, New Jersey, and before that, we'd spent some time in South America. But moving to Asia as really a 10-year-old was just such a unique experience, and it had a real formative impact on my life. And as I got older and went to college, I always had fond memories of having lived there. And once my career had started after graduate school, I began working in healthcare, and specifically, I had a number of opportunities to work in senior care from a finance and consulting point of view. And right about 2008, 2009, I had heard that, you know, there was unfolding a demographic opportunity in China. And at the time, I had just sold a business, decided that I would go and investigate. And when I got to China, I found that indeed there was an enormous story there and not a lot of native expertise in sort of the modern ways of senior care, which was something that the Chinese really, really wanted to know about. I guess it was my experience when I was younger, having lived in Taiwan, that made the transition to China very easy for me. I had some basis for the language. I knew the culture fairly well. And so I really enjoyed it. And as it turned out, I spent just about 10 years there.
The Asian culture is typically parents live with their children and the children take care of the parents. The parents gave life to children and they gave them food and clothes and education. For all the things that the children receive from the parents, the children have the eternal obligation towards them. They have a debt towards their parents, and the only thing that the children can do in order to repay is to take care of their parents in their old age. Well, so how is that culture compared to the Western culture? What is your take on how the Chinese came around to accepting senior living?
You're absolutely right about that. What you're describing here is generally referred to as the system of filial piety, and children take care of their aging parents and their grandparents for as long as they live. And that system has worked great for China for thousands of years. In the modern era, however, filial piety has been redefined. And the new definition is that I, as a young Chinese man, have a job where I'm making more money than, or young Chinese woman, we're making more money than my family's seen in centuries. And so I still want to take care of you, my parents. I still want to honor you, my parents. And so I'm going to provide for you a care level that I am incapable of doing. And so that is sort of the basis for which a modern version of senior care has developed in China.
Is having seniors move in with their adult children, is that over? Do you think the world is becoming more and more Western?
Yeah, in a certain respect, it has, but you'd be surprised that in a lot of, you know, take a step backwards. There are approximately 44,000 senior care or nursing homes in China, most of which were built in the late 80s and early 90s under various government programs. One was called the Starlight Program, and the other one was called something like the Beautiful Engineering Program. And it wasn't really until 2009 when all the demographers in China convinced the Politburo that the need for a focus on aging be included in the Shuarwu, which was the 12th fifth-year plan. China plans its economy every 5 years. And for the first time ever, the issue of aging had been mentioned in the fifth-year plan. And that brought it to everybody's attention. And all of a sudden, every real estate developer in China began building senior care facilities. The issue was they could build great senior care facilities, great apartments. It was the operational expertise and the care expertise was what escaped them. And you had a great deal, myself and a lot of my colleagues flocked to China, and we were helping them build these. And one of the interesting things that we found was that while a lot of our expertise in senior care was readily accepted, the older, you know, the residents of these communities really wanted to have a Chinese bent on their care program, which really meant, in many ways, a traditional Chinese medicine approach.
The Chinese philosophies and religions strongly influence their way of living and thinking. Their healthcare is a blend of traditional values while respecting an individual's choice. Caregivers combine information about the culture and clinical assessment to provide culturally sensitive care. Well, here's a quote from Neijing. It is from a classic Chinese medical text written to express the importance of preventative medicine. The sages of antiquity did not treat those who were already sick, but those who were not sick. When a disease has already broken out and is then only be treated, would that not be just as late as to wait for thirst before digging a well, or to wait to go into battle before casting weapons?
Well, traditional Chinese medicine, as I'm sure a lot of your viewers are acquainted with, is more preventative than it is anything else. And it's really a holistic approach to curing one's maladies. And that means the use of herbs and certain types of foods in great quantities to address ailments.
The Chinese philosophies and religion include Confucian principles, Taoism, theory of yin and yang, and Buddhism. The beliefs and values include the way of education, practice of acupuncture, herbal treatments, and diet therapy. So with regards to caregiving, the Chinese incorporate traditional Chinese medicine with Western science. Is that what you see?
They're growing really fast. Let me put it that way. I mean, they've come so far in the last 10 years, it's mind-boggling. I would generally say they're probably at the bottom of the second inning in their development. In comparison to where we are, I think they're probably someplace, you know, in the early 80s, the late 70s, early 80s. There is a fascination with the CCRC concept there, as we had back in the late 80s, but I don't expect their learning curve to last much longer. You know, in the next 5 years, they will have learned everything, and there'll be very little distinction other than the fact those facilities are Chinese and ours are American.
Let's say there are two families, each dealing with the diagnosis of dementia with a family member. In one case, the patient whose family tries to keep the diagnosis a secret and the family rely primarily on professional caregivers and eventually a nursing home. In another case, the patient is a grandmother. As soon as the diagnosis is suspected, her family pulls together, bringing her into their home and surrounding her with affection. These two approaches of dementia reflect very different attitudes towards the disease. In one scenario, it is perceived to be an irreversible neurologic condition, a problem that the family leave to the health professionals and keep it out of the public. In another scenario, the family sees it as an opportunity to draw together around the loved ones. So it's not a secret, but it is an opportunity to care. The attitude towards dementia and how the family responds to it, in my humble opinion, makes a difference on the well-being of the loved one. The shift in attitudes of dementia in China has changed tremendously. A decade ago, many families were ashamed to admit that their elders had such a disease. And because of lack of awareness about the disease, many dementia patients were confined to a psychiatric wards of hospitals, which placed steel bars over the windows. So what do you see the difference of the attitude of dementia between the Western and the Chinese culture?
To a certain extent, they're similar. I mean, you know, dementia presents itself in the same way, whether you're Chinese or whether you're Caucasian. Here in the United States and just generally in the West, and just as full disclosure, I'm not a doctor and I'm certainly not a memory care specialist, but I have been around it for long enough to know what I see. To my sensitivity, today we're sort of in the third era of dementia understanding. The first era was sort of characterized by extremely barbaric care. It was restraining these individuals. Oftentimes they were thought of as having been invaded by evil spirits. And that lasted for quite a long time until doctors realized, having performed medical tests on those who were deceased, that really the cause of many types of dementia was, you know, the twisting of neurons and their binding by these clumpy proteins. And that gave way to what is generally known as the amyloid hypothesis. And around that rose all of these psychostimulant drugs. And for a long time, that was the way that we would deal with dementia patients, and that we would give them all these drugs. And pharmaceutical companies spent billions and billions of dollars developing these. Today, I see us more in sort of the third era of our advancement here, which is really a relief. And some of the academic research has shown that these psychostimulants are just an enormous problem. They often create more problems than they solve. And there have been a number of researchers out there who said we should step back and look at this disease much more holistically. And the papers that have been produced here suggest that there are lots of ways that dementia can be addressed. Still, there's no cure, of course, and there won't be a cure for quite some time. In that respect, it's a lot like cancer, you know? There are so many different types of dementia. But there are things that can be done that have been proven to alleviate some of the conditions and sometimes even delay the later stages of dementia. For example, I was reading a paper the other day that suggested that in the gut microbiome, there are things that go on that can lead to early onset of dementia or even aggravate if you already have it. And it went on to suggest that certain things, certain foodstuffs, diets high in carbohydrate, diets high in processed foods are possibly the worst things that you could possibly be eating. Not just as an older person, but as somebody in their 30s and 40s.
Yes, we do have control over the six pillars for a brain-healthy lifestyle, and that includes regular exercise, social engagement, healthy diet, mental stimulation, quality sleep, and stress management.
Precisely, and there have also been studies about oral hygiene. Those who pay a lot of attention to oral hygiene and the reduction of plaque in the mouth, that also has a profound link to the onset of dementia. And so all this good hygiene and good diet plays a very important role into how things eventually unfold. I have a friend of mine who has experimented with the keto diet on a number of his patients. And the results, of course, are a significant drop in weight and a recognition that is astounding. And the keto diet just sort of goes to underscore how a diet rich in vegetable fat seems to be much better for you than a diet rich in carbohydrates.
Ketogenic diet is high in fats, very low in carbs, with moderate protein. The brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease start to lose the ability to use carbohydrates, but may still be able to use ketones. If you adhere to a Mediterranean-based heart and brain-healthy diet, some people believe it may lower the risk of Alzheimer's. What's good for the heart is good for the brain. So now that you are working on your own creation of a diet drink that's keto-friendly, so tell us about that.
Oh, you mean the diet drink that I've been working on? You know, there are a number of diet drinks out there that are keto friendly, but there's really not a drink that contains a significant amount of fat, and fat being the energy source for keto diets. My friend and I developed a drink that gets its fat from coconut. We've extracted all the sugar and we've come up with two different flavors right now. One of them is a coconut vanilla flavor and the other one is a chocolate flavor. We've test marketed them in Australia and we're developing a strawberry drink as well as a coffee flavor. And we hope to be able to bring it to the United States sometime later this year.
So please send me a sample. There has been significant changes in senior living over the years, with more focus on healthcare services, promoting fitness and wellness by providing individualized care in a comfortable, home-like environment. There are services to help residents enjoy their retirement with other people of the same age and promote the idea of aging in place. So what is your take on the changes of senior living over the years?
Well, you know, obviously the industry has matured a great deal. One of the things that I see that's really refreshing, you know, back in the late 80s, early 90s, there was this whole culture change movement, which led us away from the medical model of care to more of a holistic, more of a focus on wellness. And today, there's been a movement towards this, the so-called aging in place, which I think is just very refreshing. Why not stay at home and adapt familiar surroundings to your present condition? That is, to my mind, I think one of the best ways to live out your maturity. The other thing that I've been seeing a lot of in the last 5 to 10 years are, you know, diaspora of elderly to foreign lands. Costa Rica is a well-known destination for the elderly to move. And in Asia, I see a lot of Australians choosing to live out to do senior living in Thailand, in Vietnam. And that's for a number of different reasons. One, first, the weather is beautiful in these places, Costa Rica, Thailand, Vietnam. And two, the standard of living is enormously low. I know people who live in Vietnam for $1,200 a month. And healthcare in Thailand, healthcare in these other places is very good, especially in Thailand. It's extremely good.
Healthcare systems are influenced by the national objectives. It's also influenced by the structure of the government and its economic conditions. Countries like Thailand is becoming not only vacation destination, but also retirement destination.
Absolutely. Thailand has developed a medical tourism industry that is second to none, I guess, maybe a trail Singapore, but it's extremely, extremely affordable and very high quality.
Some of the best places to retire in Asia are Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Thailand, and Taiwan.
Yeah. In fact, I've got friends in Australia who recently retired, and they spend 9 months out of the year in a little beach resort area called Mui Ne, which is not far from the old Saigon or Ho Chi Minh, as we call it today. They bought a condo there, and they're just really have an idyllic life.
There are many things Vietnam is famous for. Besides being a Southeast Asian country, people come to Vietnam due to the ancient history, diverse culture, and its beautiful natural landscapes.
Well, it's a fascinating place, and it never fails to stimulate and amaze. You know, it's just a deep, rich culture, and I've never had a bad experience really anywhere in Asia, especially in all my travels and 10 years in China.
So what languages do you speak, or how many languages do you speak?
None, really. I'm still working on English, right? No, I mean, I spent a number of years in South America when I was a youngster, and I picked up a lot of Spanish there. And in high school, for some reason, I was fascinated by French. I think it was just the fad of the time. And so I studied French throughout high school, and I went to college there for about a year in France. And of course, you know, I lived in Taiwan for a while. I developed my ear for Mandarin when I was in Taiwan. And I really picked up a great deal of what they call Putonghua, which is the official language of China, while I was living there. I can't write Chinese. That requires a focus and a dedication that I just didn't have. But I can get myself through most trouble with the language with my level of Mandarin.
My English is not that good either. I believe by now it is what it is and not likely to get better. I do speak Vietnamese and regret that I should have done a better job in teaching my children how to speak Vietnamese better. While Vietnamese is a singular official and national language of the country, there are 110 officially recognized dialects and languages spoken in Vietnam.
Well, you know, Vietnamese is an interesting language. It's a derivative of a number of Asian languages. There's a fair amount of Chinese and Vietnamese. I find most curious that today they no longer use traditional Vietnamese writing. In fact, Vietnamese haven't used their traditional writing in almost 150, 175 years.
Alexander de Rhodes, a French Jesuit missionary who came to Vietnam in 1627. Within 6 months of his arrival, de Rhodes was preaching in Vietnamese fluently. In Vietnamese, each syllable has one of six tones, which completely alters the meaning of the word, and one, two, or three of 11 distinct vowel sounds.
I think it was a French missionary who developed the writing they have today.
So what impact are you making in senior living or for the baby boomers?
Well, having just returned from the time that I spent in Asia, I promised my family that I was going to spend some time with them. And I don't think I'm really going to jump back into any long-term scale projects for another few months. I'm quite satisfied right now with working on small little projects like the keto drink that I'm working on right now. And I'd like to continue working in the dementia field, trying to provide solutions to make people's lives easier and to raise awareness on how healthy lifestyles can help offset or delay the onset of dementia.
According to a research published by the World Health Organization, the number of people with Alzheimer's disease around the world is expected to reach 75.6 million by 2030. The number of people with dementia in China is also projected to be 14.1 million by this year, in 23.3 million by 2030, costing the country up to $114.2 billion. This is according to the World Health Organization.
Having been born in the early 60s, I'm sort of the tail end of the boomers. And I may be living a fantasy here, but I mean, at my age, I feel enormously healthy. I don't have anywhere near the aches and pains that my children complain about on a daily basis. I work out at least once every 2 days. I walk 15 to 20,000 steps a day. I think that aging for me, meaningful aging, where you become infirm and fragile, serious decline, I don't see where that begins for most of us who stay healthy. We're so much more aware of that today than the previous generation was. And so I don't see meaningful or infirmity for another 30, 40 years at the very earliest.
We live in a country that has resources for us to have a brain-healthy lifestyle. Some things that we do have control over, for example, are cardio exercise and strength training, weight and resistance training. Human beings are highly social creatures. We don't thrive in isolation, and neither do our brains. So we need to develop and maintain a strong network of friends, eat a healthy diet, get a good amount of sleep, manage your stress. The discipline and the commitment to do all of these things are hard, but the resources are readily available.
Well, I'm much more aware of it. And as I get older, of course, you know, I have parents who also age, and I'm just more in tune to some of the issues that people around me are experiencing. And based on my experience and what I've done for a big part of my career, I'm able to make suggestions and offer advice to people where someone who's not in the industry would have an enormous learning curve in front of them. And I find that because I'm in the industry, a lot of my colleagues, all of my friends will often ask me, what should they do in this situation? Or where should they look for a community, for their parents? You know, inevitably, people who are in this industry are the source of a lot of inquiries and a lot of information for their family and friends. I had no idea that I'd end up in this type of, a lot of people ask me, so why are you in healthcare? Why are you involved in the aging industry? And my flip answer to that is, I'm just lucky, right? But it came about quite by accident. And after I'd gotten out of graduate school, I found myself in a bullpen in an investment bank, being called upon to work on various different projects. And it just so happened that I was asked to work on this one portfolio of loans, which were secured by healthcare properties. We won that bid, and that was it.
You have a long history with China.
a relationship and roots with the people. You even have a Chinese name.
Yeah, you know, it's funny how that worked out, sure enough. And the whole China thing, people often ask me not just why you went, but how was it that you were able to stay there for so long? And my simple answer is, if you know the story about the one-eyed man in the land of the blind, you have your answer.
Here are some interesting facts about Asia. Asia's population of over 4 billion people is greater than that of all the other continents combined. Both the highest point on land, which is Mount Everest, and the lowest point on land, the Dead Sea, are found in Asia. It is a continent of varied landscape. In 2005, a Chinese billionaire built the world's largest shopping mall in Dongguan, China. It is so big, it boasts of an indoor roller coaster. What's even more interesting is that since it opened, 99% of the mall has remained unoccupied. China is so wide that it naturally and should cut across up to 5 separate time zones, but it only has one national time zone, which is China Standard Time. Japan is a wonderful place to live, just as long as you don't get fat, because it's against the law. Of the top 10 tallest buildings in the world, 9 are found in Asia. Only 2 countries in the world, India and China, have a population above 1 billion people, and both of them are in Asia. The 10 largest shopping malls in the world are also located in Asia. Being over 100 years of age is amazing, but in Japan, there are over 50,000 people who have surpassed this 100-year mark. Everyone in Vietnam has the same birthday, which is celebrated on the Vietnamese New Year, also known as Tết.
There's tons of opportunity. Even in your homeland, Vietnam, it tends to be today, demographically, it's a very, very young country. I think only 5% of the population is over 65 years old. But I've been to Vietnam a number of times for the aging industry. There are a number of companies who are very farsighted and are trying to think about, not just trying to think about, they are actually working on developing senior communities.
Do you speak the native language or do they speak English to you?
Sure. English is the most widely spoken language in the world. And I've traveled throughout most countries in Asia with the exception of, I've not yet been to Bhutan, which is someplace I'd really like to go there. But there's not much senior living in Bhutan these days. To be specific about your answer, usually when I travel to a country, it's because I've been invited by a colleague or a business that's interested in the work that I've done there. And so they're prepared for my arrival, and there's usually a translator. But I've always been humbled by the degree to which people speak my language. I always try and show my gratitude when I'm traveling in these places by learning a few words of their language. That goes a long way.
The Chinese investors were totally dependent on the Western partners' management and operational know-how. The Chinese owners prefer short-term operational support from the Western partners for about 2 to 3 years before they establish themselves for independent operations. The senior care sector does not have global brands like the hospitality sector, which has well-established global brands that are household names. This means there are not as many best practices for domestic senior care sector to adapt from the internationally recognized best practices. Most foreign investors that are entered China a few years ago are facing similar challenges that the U.S. is facing, which are locating, hiring, training, and retaining talent. So what do the Chinese import from the U.S. and what do we import from China with regard to senior living?
If you're referring to specifically construction techniques, I don't think that there's anything that we can import from them in that respect. In fact, today they're importing all of our architectural concepts entirely. What does come the other way, meaning the things that we import from China, you know, the furniture that are, you know, that's used in a lot of senior communities throughout this country is, of course, as you can imagine, all made in China. Most of the medical devices, or a lot of them, I would say, have their origin in China, if not elsewhere in Asia, perhaps even India. And even, much to my dismay, a lot of our pharmaceuticals are manufactured in China. So a lot of the tangential products that are used in the aging industry have been manufactured in China for the last 20 years.
Any more thoughts on the Chinese culture, healthy living, attitude towards dementia?
Well, other than our discussion about dementia and where we are today and the fact that pharmaceuticals, you know, the psychostimulants really have proven to be, maybe saying that they're an enormous failure is a bit harsh, but I think that they serve very few well in this industry. And the new holistic approaches, the approaches that involve diet, hygiene, and activity, meaning don't sit in front of the TV for 10 hours a day, those type of things will serve you much better if you're going to end up getting dementia. Some people have a congenital issue, and it's going to happen anyway, but I think that you can delay the onset, certainly by improving your lifestyle dramatically.
Yes, it is important to have a brain-healthy lifestyle, such as cardio exercise, training, weight and resistance training, stimulate the brain by maintaining a strong network of friends, eat a healthy diet, get a good amount of sleep, and manage your stress.
That's true. And even being in healthcare myself, you know, every now and then I'll get into a rut and I'll acquire bad habits. I'm just coming off of what will end up being a 14-day lemonade diet, where I will shed an enormous amount of weight to get back to sort of my high school weight. I do this periodically because, you know, in our day and age and the traveling that I do, some things are hard to avoid. But one of the things I've started doing in the last year, and I posted this on LinkedIn just the other day, is this idea of periodic fasting. And the information that's on LinkedIn under my bio that you can find is a study done by this group of researchers which say fasting for a period of 18 hours every few days has enormous benefits for your health, as well as it potentially has, at least in the animals that they used in the research, it extended their lives dramatically. So needless to say, fasting is one of my new things. And the way I feel at the end of a fast is extraordinary. I have amazing energy.
Really? So after your fast, and what's the first thing you do?
Well, after a fast, in order to get back into eating, then again, I'll probably only eat for a day or two normally. I'll just have broths, simple foods, a vegetable soup, something like that. And it won't be until the end of that eating regime, which lasts for maybe 24 to 36 hours. I won't be eating solid foods. I'll still eat meat, chicken and pork, and every now and then some red meat. But the re-entry into eating is always very simple and very gentle.
Nice. Well, I am in my mid-50s, and I am at my high school weight and pre-pregnant weight after 3 kids.
Yep.
That's right. It's because I aim to do all the things that we talked about earlier. I'm not always successful, but I do aim to get a good amount of exercise, sleep, have a healthy diet, and manage my stress. So how are you doing with achieving your high school weight?
I'm pretty close to that. I've been in this diet now for about 12 days, and it's called a lemonade diet because all you do is drink this concoction of water, lemon juice, and maple syrup as long as you want. And I've been on it for close to 2 weeks now, and I've dropped almost 20 pounds.
Well, congratulations.
It's not for everybody, understand. Basically, I'm a relatively healthy person, and certainly you should see a doctor before you do anything like this. But my doctor has always told me that he doesn't really care how I lose weight. The risks of keeping weight on far outweigh the risks of losing that weight. So I'm coming off this diet on Sunday, and I can't tell you how hungry I am right now.
So what do you plan to eat?
It'll be a chicken broth. To me, it does right now. After almost 2 weeks, I can't wait to taste that.
What's your thoughts and plans for yourself and for your loved ones, senior living options?
You know, I mentioned earlier in this discussion that one of the things that I think is a good idea for most people, and that is really to find a way to remain at home for as long as possible. And that's true for a number of reasons. Most importantly, psychologically moving from the place where you've lived for so long, it's rough to go to a new place when you're at an advanced age. It can be very disruptive to your life. And so adjusting your environment that you're most familiar with and adapting it to your needs, I think is probably what I would recommend to everyone around me. And when there's no other choice, then I would, of course, agree and recommend an alternative location, whatever really going to best serve that person.
Affordability, home care, long-term care insurance are all huge considerations.
On that note, I would recommend everybody to seriously look into long-term care insurance. That's a must, maybe even more important than life insurance.
So do you have any other thoughts, anything you want to share to our listeners?
For all your listeners, you know, if they're interested in what's going on in China and if they're involved in the industry, I've written two books about the emerging senior care industry in China. And those are available on Amazon. If you go to Amazon and you just search under my name, Brahmi, B-R-O-M-M-E, Cole, you'll find the two books. The second book is probably the best of the two, but both of them give a good idea of what's emerging over there. And if they're in the senior industry here in the United States, it'll provide an interesting perspective.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you very much, too. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, it was a pleasure to have Brahmi Cole share his journey in Asia and his experience with China's rich culture, his work with the Chinese senior living, also Brahmi's secret to a baby boomer's healthy lifestyle with chicken broth keto diet in achieving his high school weight. Well, thank you so much, Brahmi, and I look forward to talking to you again. Thank you so much for joining us this week on Boomer Living TV's podcast. Make sure to visit our website, boomerliving.tv, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and other platforms. This way, you'll never miss a show. And while you're at it, if you found value in this show, we would really appreciate a rating in iTunes or simply tell a friend about the show. That would help us tremendously. Be sure to tune in weekly for our next episode. And remember, growing old is the purest and the most positive experience of human existence.